The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Hello, this is Frank Urban from the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next half hour, I'll be reading from Smithsonian. Today's programming is underwritten with the generous support of Carl and Pat Kappen, and we wish to thank them for their support. Metal detectorist discovers Black Death period coins. The treasure dates back to the reign of Edward III and probably belonged to a wealthy person in England. One highlight of the find included a rare leopard coin. Officials considered this coinage failed because the costs for producing them were too high. By Isis Davis Marks. An English metal detectorist has discovered two rare gold coins dating back to the 14th century. As Stuart Anderson reports for the Eastern Daily Press, the treasure hunter unearthed the coins in Reepham, R-E-E-P-H-A-M, a small town in southwest England, in 2019. Together, both coins are worth an estimated £12,000, or $16,650, and someone at the top of society probably owned them, the BBC writes. It seems likely that both coins went into the ground at the same time, either as part of a purse loss or as part of a concealed hoard, the United Kingdom's Portable Antiquities Scheme notes in a statement. One of the finds was a 23-carat gold leopard, which was minted in 1344, and the other coin was a type of noble, which was minted in 1351 or 2. Both pieces portray Edward III, who tried to bring gold coinage to England in 1344. The leopard coin, also known as a half florin, was only minted from January to July 1344, though the 0.12-ounce medallion is considered valuable now. This type of currency was considered a failure when it was initially created because the costs of producing the coins were too high. The value given to them was also disproportionate to the cost of silver, according to the statement. According to Live Sciences' Laura Kigel, Edward III introduced new coins from 1344 to 1351 to solve these issues. Craftsmen minted the 0.3-ounce noble during this period. Both coins were relatively well-preserved and had only slight scratches, likely a result of agricultural activity. If a local coroner, an independent legal authority, reviews the discoveries, then they may be classified as treasures, a term that refers to bona fide, often metal artifacts that meet specific archaeological criteria outlined by the PAS, notes Laura Kegel for Life Science in a separate article. In the UK, amateur treasure hunters are required to hand their finds, F-I-N-D-S, not finds as in a fine, to hand their finds over to local authorities. Current guidelines define treasure relatively strictly, but as Caroline Davies reports for The Guardian last December, the UK government is working to expand these parameters to better protect the country's national heritage items. Objects designated as treasure become the property of the state and may be displayed at national or local museums. These finds were particularly notable because hardly any have survived, notes BBC News. The coins may help experts to understand historical changes to English currency after the Norman conquest. The Royal Treasury might talk in terms of pounds, shillings, and pence, but the physical reality was sacks of silver pennies, archaeologist Helen Greek tells BBC News. Then Edward III decided to reintroduce the first gold coins in England since the Anglo-Saxon era. No one knows why. Eventually, England's government melted down most of the leopards and recast them. Once the leopard was taken out of circulation, officials replaced it with a noble, which was worth 6 shillings 8 pence, according to BBC News. Almost none of the leopards survived because they were all pulled back in and reminted, and this is the first time that we know of that. One has been found with another coin. Geek tells the Eastern Daily Press it implies that this leopard is either in circulation or being held onto by someone who thinks it is worth it, which scholars believe that one reason for the leopard's uncharacteristically long circulation is that the Black Death came to England in the late 1340s and killed at least one-third of the population, which would have distracted government authorities from less immediate issues like coin circulation. Usually, the authorities would be keen to remove a withdrawn coin as soon as possible, but the Black Death probably prevented this from happening, Geek tells Live Science. And that was written by freelance writer Isis, Davis Marks, and she's a freelance writer and artist based in New York City. Her work has also appeared in Artsy, the Columbia Journal, and elsewhere. Up next, a peek inside the world's greatest record store. And there's a picture with colorful 45 RPM records. A lovable grouch, obsessed with the magic of American sidewalk harmony, runs the Philadelphia Shop, by Richard Grant. I first heard about Val Shively, a legendary figure among serious record collectors, from a friend of mine in Philadelphia named Aaron Levinson. He's a Grammy-winning music producer, composer, DJ, and rare vinyl collector who has been buying records from Shively for 40 years. He has a store called R&B Records in this sketchy neighborhood out past West Philly, Levinson told me. The building is listing like the Tower of Pisa because he's got 5 million records in there. It's likely the biggest record store in the world, and collectors fly in from the UK, Germany, Japan, and wherever else in order to buy from Val. But if they see something wrong or he doesn't like their attitude, he explodes into an unbelievable rage and throws them out of the store. Levinson continued, he's a born-again Christian who curses like a mobster. He's a white guy who went nuts for black music when he was young and never recovered. He's the authoritative collector of doo-wop records on the planet and one of the greatest record collectors of all time, even though his genre is narrow. I asked Levinson about the possibility of interviewing Shively and writing about him. I'll see what I can do, Levinson said. He'll probably test you first or make you run some kind of gauntlet, but at this stage of his life, he might appreciate the validation. 2 days later, Levinson gave me Shively's cell phone number and a word of advice. Don't use the term doo-wop, he said. Val and his dwindling band of fanatics call them group harmony records, or group records, he explained. I called the number. Shively made some small talk and then launched into a monologue, talking fast with an abrasive Philly accent. Actually, a Delaware County, Pennsylvania accent, I found out later. He was describing a recent period of psychological malaise. I'm a Christian, okay, and I was praying, but nothing was happening, he said. I couldn't see the point. The music, my life, my record collection, the store, and I had no energy. He's 77 years old. I thought, maybe that's the problem. But in the last few days, he said the empty feel had lifted, his energy had returned, and he was feeling like himself again. I asked him what he thought accounted for the change. To be honest, I have no clue, he said. Then he asked, what do you know about my type of music, the group stuff? Very little, I said. I know more about soul and funk. I told him I was looking for a vinyl copy of No Man Is an Island by the Van Dykes, a fairly obscure Texas soul group from the 1960s. Oh, that's good. You know them? He said. They sound like four guys, but there's only three of them. Normally, three guys sound like whale, you know what, sinking to the bottom of the ocean. Then he summarized the army career of the Van Dyke's falsetto lead, vocalist Rondellis Tandy, and how the group was formed, who their influences were, the different record labels they were on, their best songs, and how and when they broke up. That segued into a series of stories about accidental improvisations in recording studios that led to big hits, the influence of mobsters in the music business, and singers who were in prison for murder while their hit songs climbed the charts. This amazingly well-informed soliloquy went on for 25 minutes. Then he said, "Okay, get over here, and I'll do whatever you want. What's your address? I'm sending you a package." The package contained his religious testimony photocopied on a sheet of yellow paper and five home-burned CDs featuring 149 rare African-American doo-wop songs, mostly recorded between 1956 and 1959. A hand-scrawled letter stressed the importance of listening to the CDs in order. On the CD cases were blurry photocopied photographs of Shively at various stages in his career. The teenage Val holding up a 45 single, mustachioed Val in the 1970s wearing a cowboy shirt, late middle-aged Val in a turtleneck sweater. The wall of records behind him remained almost the same in each image. I listened to the CDs on the plane to Philadelphia, cocooned in my headphones, transported back to an era when cars had tail fins, and young men in African-American neighborhoods sang harmonies on street corners and formed groups such as the Quails, the Larks, the Feathers, the Opals, the Paragons, the Spaniels. I was a newcomer to this music, and at first it sounded too stylized, sentimental, and formulaic for my taste. Then the form of the music started to fade away, and my ears opened up to the amazing lead vocal performances, the precision of the accompanying oohs and wop-wops, and the yearning, aching emotions evoked by the songs. Street corner opera is how Levinson describes this music. The cult is around lead singers with crazy upper registers, plus the lushness and intricacy of the harmony singers. That's what Val fell in love with, and he never really moved on. He just tunneled deeper and deeper into it. From the center of Philadelphia, Levinson and I took the subway out to 69th Street and emerged into the gritty, multi-ethnic streets of Upper Darby. We ate lunch in a Latin diner while Shively finished up his church services, and then we walked over to his store. Actually, we walked right past his store, realized our mistake, and turned back again. R&B Records had no sign or display windows, just a metal frame door in the blank wall of a three-story building with a noticeable lean. On the door was a Do Not Enter sign, quote, "unless you know what you want," printed across it in tiny letters. Another sign said, "new rules, 5 minutes and you're gone." I was puzzled, so Levinson explained. Val doesn't allow browsing. Most of his business is mail order, and if you come here as a customer, you need to have a list of what you want. And if you haggle over prices or complain that he doesn't have something or act just a little bit snotty, you're out the door. Stepping inside, I was confronted by a scene of overwhelming chaos and claustrophobic madness. Vinyl records were stacked on shelves to the high ceiling, with insanely narrow aisles between the towering stacks, and debris and garbage everywhere. The store hadn't been cleaned in decades. Cats prowled around. A plastic skeleton hung from the ceiling with a sign on its midriff said, "the last guy we caught stealing." Another sign read, "trespassers will be shot. Survivors will be prosecuted." And there, in a small island of space, sitting at a scarred old desk heaped with Rolodexes, vinyl 45s, crumpled trash, and random novelty items, was the white-haired emperor of this extraordinary domain. When he said, fat people can't come in here, he was not stating a policy. He was describing a physical reality. Levinson and I were of average girth. The only way we could fit through the aisle to Shively's desk was to turn sideways and shuffle. He greeted us with an exuberant burst of profanity. He threw his arms out. Look at this, he said, complete insanity. Of the 5 million vinyl records that he estimated were in the building on two stories above us in equally overcrowded conditions and in the truly hellish chaos of the basement, more than 4 million were 7-inch 45 RPM singles. He bought them in bulk from bankrupt jukebox companies, radio stations, record companies, record stores, pressing plants, distributors, and individual collectors. Nothing in here is computerized, he said. I hate computers, and we don't need them. Chuck knows where everything is. He called out for his assistant, Chuck DeBagian, from a dimly lit slot canyon in the far stack, shuffling smoothly sideways, there emerged a calm, introverted man who started working for Val as a teenager in 1972. Like his boss, DeBagian commands a mind-boggling knowledge of American music and African-American music in particular. Everything in the store is arranged by record label. Then it's alphabetized, DeBagian said. Val and I knew all the labels, which label the original pressing was on and which label the other pressings were on. Labels are a sickness, said Shively. When I started collecting, I didn't give a you-know-what about labels. Then I had to have everything on the original label, even if it took all the money I had. You start out loving the music, and then it takes over your life. But hey, it's been a great life, and I wouldn't trade it for all the money in the world. In 1956, at the age of 12, Val Shively heard Don't Be Cruel by Elvis Presley for the first time. He was never the same again. That record destroyed me, he said. We had no money, so our neighbors bought me a record player. It hooked into the back of the television, and I played through the speakers. I would climb behind the TV and listen to that record for hours and hours. I drove my parents nuts. He was already a collector of stamps and coins. Now he focused on records and became obsessed with music. For his 13th birthday, he was given a transistor radio. I found a big, thick book, The Life of Samuel Johnson, cut the middle out of it and put the radio in there, he said. I punched holes on the cover so I could listen to the radio all day at school and under my pillow at night. I had a paper route, and whenever I had money, it was records, records, records. By age 15, his collection numbered in the thousands. One day, in 1960, Shively turned the dial of his transistor all the way over to the right-hand side and landed on a black radio station for the first time. It blew my mind hearing Etta James, Baby Washington, Valerie by Jackie and the Starlights, he said. I like a lot of white music. I love old country. But for me, black music has more force, more originality, and more longevity. And once I got into the black harmony groups, that was it. Nothing ever sounded so good to me. He had no girlfriend or social life. He hated school. All of his free time was spent in the pursuit of group harmony 45s. And like any true collector, he was inexorably drawn to the rare and elusive. Collecting is all about the hunt, he said. You move heaven and earth and pay whatever it takes to get that one record. But once you have it, it's just another record and you hardly ever play it. Some people call it an addiction. I call it a disease. Hunting for these doo-wop gems, most of which were recorded by teenage nobodies and sold very few copies, Shively searched through record stores all over Philadelphia. On weekends, he caught the bus to New York City and made his way to Times Square Records, known familiarly as Slim's, a scruffy little store in Manhattan, presided over by Irving Slim Rose. That was the doo-wop mecca in the early 1960s, and a hotbed for the scamming and hustling that goes on among collectors. People tricking each other, bluffing, double-crossing, trying to pass off bootlegs, It's all part of the game, said Schlively. Everyone is trying to get the rarest, most valuable records for the least amount of money. To finance his collecting, Schlively started selling records. In 62, I had a record player in my car, and I'd make the rounds on payday, he said. I'd say to people, get in the car and listen to this. I sold a lot of records that way. But this has never been about money. This has always been about me having the greatest collection of the music I love as a way to be somebody. These ambitions were hard on Val's mother, who wanted him to have a professional career. To keep her happy, and because he was good with numbers, he trained as an accountant. Then, to his mother's horror, he got a job doing the books for a record distributor. Not the records again, she lamented. And also delivering records to stores in North Philadelphia. Sometimes he bought so many records on his rounds that it canceled out his paycheck. In 1966, he started sending out a small catalog to fellow Group Harmony collectors, offering records for sale and listing the rarities he wanted to buy. That was the beginning of a mail-order business that continues today. In 1972, Schlively quit his job with the distributor and started selling mail-order records out of his house. It was financially sustainable, but the isolation got to him. I'm famous for throwing people out of my store, but I love people and I need to be around them, he said. That's why, in November 1972, he opened the original R&B Records, a few blocks away from its current location. He moved into his current space in 1990 and then gradually lost control of it. I like a scruffy aesthetic, like Slim's used to be, but I never intended for the store to get this bad. I buy like a hog. That's the real problem. In 91, I bought 1,000,000 45s from a jukebox company that went bust in New Orleans. They were heavy on soul, and that's my best-selling stuff now. Soul, funk, gospel. That's what people come from Europe and Japan to buy. I asked him when he last threw someone out of the store. Oh, no, I don't do that anymore, he said. That's not true, said Dabagian. He still uses the eject button. What about the guy the other week? Shively's eyes bulged, his face flushed with rage at the thought of that guy. Don't come in here and tell me how to run my business. Only one customer entered the store the afternoon I was there. He was a 74-year-old named William Carter who started buying records here 30 years ago. I'm a 45 man, he told me. I want to play what I want to play. On a CD or an album, you have to play what they want you to listen to. He gave his list to Schlively, who handed it to Dabagian, who shuffled off on a goat path into the stacks. As I eavesdropped on his conversation with Carter, Schlively revealed another side of himself. This famous, irascible crank could also be warm, kind, and generous, and empathetic. A solid friend. Before he left the store with his records, Carter said, Val is a good man with a good heart. Don't let anybody tell you different. It was now late in the afternoon, and Dabagian was dispatched into the stacks for one last errand. When he reappeared, he was holding a vinyl 45, No Man is an Island, by the Van Dykes. Then Schlively closed up the store and drove Levinson and me to his home to meet his wife, Patty. They met 50 years ago on a blind date at a bowling alley and show us his record collection. Two stories high on a quiet, leafy street in a solidly middle-class neighborhood, the house could have belonged to a dentist or a high school principal. It was attractively furnished and, compared with R&B records, shockingly clean and uncluttered. I'm a claustrophobic neat freak, Patty said. I hate going into Val's store. I won't do it anymore. Now retired from a managerial job at a life insurance company, Patty had a slightly long-suffering air when it came to Shively's obsession. She had once organized a Wives Against Collecting club, and she became furious some years ago when her husband gave the wrong answer to the following question. If the house was burning down, which would you save first, me or the records? Schlively said, I've learned the right answer to that question now. I just needed a little help. Patty had no interest in Shively's music, and at their wedding 20 years ago, she dismissed the vocal harmony group that he had hired. "It sounded like a funeral dirge," she said. "Me and my friends wanted to dance." At the top of the stairs, Shively unlocked a door, and we gazed at a wall of approximately 11,000 group harmony 45s, all first pressings, all the finest copies known to exist, nearly all in mint or close to mint condition. They were neatly shelved in brown covers and arranged carefully by label. "This is what I'm all about," said Shively. "This is what I've been doing my whole life." One of his most prized possessions, for which he paid $10,000, is "Can't Help Loving That Girl of Mine" by the Hideaways on Ronnie Records. "It's probably the most desirable record in the whole shooting match," he said. "Not only is it a rare record, it's a great record, and they never made a dime off it." Then he pulled out "Rosemary" by the Five Chimes on Betta, a record so rare it was thought to exist only on bootlegs. "I'm not happy to say that I paid $16,000 for this one," he said. "That's the most I've ever spent on a record." For every single record in the collection, Shively had stories, information, minutia. He told us about the performers and their relatives, what happened to them later in life. He knew where the songs came from and the backing musicians. There were also 11,000 stories about hunting down and gaining possession of the records in nerve-wracking blind auctions conducted by telephone with other collectors around the country, in miracle dumpster finds behind defunct radio stations, in hard-boiled negotiations with his peers. Shively's personal collection, the crowning achievement of his life, was also his biggest problem. "I hate to sell it because it means so much to me, but I don't want to dump the problem on Patty when I die," he said. She doesn't need to sell off all these records, which are worth millions of dollars, or deal with the people who want to buy them. He stared at the wall of records. "I don't know what I'm going to do," he said. "I can't be alive and not have this." Shively's nearest equivalent in the rare record trade is perhaps John Tefteller, a mail-order dealer in Oregon recognized as having the best collection of blues 78s and 45s. "As soon as I knew anything about collecting, I knew about Val, and over the years we became friends," he told me. Tefteller recently came up with a suggestion that perhaps the Library of Congress could purchase Shively's collection. "That's where it belongs," says Tefteller. "It is the single best collection of R&B vocal harmony groups on the planet, and no other collections come close to it. If it were broken up and sold to other collectors, you could never again recreate the collection." Well, that was a fun read. I hope you've enjoyed it as much as I did, today's reading from Smithsonian. Be sure to listen next time. I'm Frank Urban, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's programming is underwritten with the generous support of Carl and Pat Kappen. We thank them for their support. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast on our website, ncreadingservice.org. So long until next time. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. We'd love to hear from you.